Hello and welcome to this month's Life Notes, which move you one book closer to living 12 categories smart. This is Jesse Colhagen, and you're listening to the Life Note, Thinking Fast and Slow, by Daniel Kahneman, and summarized by Marcia Joseph. As always, we'll begin with a quote. As we navigate our lives, we normally allow ourselves to be guided by impressions and feelings, and the confidence we have in our intuitive beliefs and preferences is usually justified, but not always. We are often confident even when we are wrong. End quote. Daniel Kahneman, in Thinking Fast and Slow, gives the reader a wealth of new insights about how the mind works. The author is a renowned psychologist who received the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on decision-making. In the book, we learn how there are two systems in the mind that influence how we think. System 1, which is faster and more intuitive, and System 2, which is slower, more rational, and used for more complex tasks. Throughout the book, we learn about how these two systems work and the impact they have on our lives. He shares many other research-based insights about how the mind works that you can apply in your everyday life. This is a cerebral and thought-provoking book packed with interesting information that can fill in some of the gaps in the mysterious roadmap of the mind. So let's get started. Big thought number one, two systems of the mind, fast and slow thinking. Quote, the division of labor between system one and system two is highly efficient. It minimizes effort and optimizes performance. End quote. In the first part of the book, Daniel Kahneman explains how we have two systems in the mind, or two modes of thinking that he refers to as System 1 and System 2. In System 1, the thinking is faster and automatic without a lot of effort. For example, recognizing hostility in someone's voice or noticing an angry expression would be a System 1 activity. In contrast, System 2 requires giving focused attention to more complex problems or choices, such as filling out a tax form or picking out the particular voice of a person in a crowd. Our minds generally rely more on the intuitions and impulses of System 1. On an ongoing basis, System 1 is generating impressions, intuitions, and feelings, and System 2 will adopt those. However, when there's no automatic or expected answer, System 2 kicks in to solve the more complex problem. This all sounds well and good, but once in a while, our two different systems can trip us up in certain ways. You can be so busy concentrating with System 2 hard at work that you might not even notice something completely obvious, like a gorilla, in fact. An experiment was cited from the book The Invisible Gorilla, where participants watched a short video of a basketball game and were asked to count the number of passes the team wearing the white shirts made and to completely ignore the activity from the team with the black shirts. This was a complex task. Halfway through the video, a woman wearing a gorilla suit runs through the middle of the court, pounds her chest, and is visible for 9 whole seconds. The author notes that thousands have seen the video, and over half of them do not even notice the gorilla. This is an example of how we can be completely blind to the obvious based on how our minds work. In our normal world, gorillas do not run into the middle of basketball courts, so the gorilla was ignored while the participants' minds were concentrating on the complex task. They were completely in System 2 mode. Now, you're probably not going to need to be too worried about seeing gorillas anytime soon, but you might want to think twice about having a complex discussion about your year-end financial statements while you're driving, right? In addition to learning about how we can be blind to the obvious, Daniel Kahneman also explains how we have limited energy for making complex decisions, and when System 2 becomes busy and depleted, we have less self-control. If you've just been given a demanding mental task, such as remembering a long list of numbers, for example, it's more likely that you'll choose cake rather than fruit. Unless, of course, you're a Lifebook member with a clear health and fitness vision, in which case you'll probably always choose the fruit. The point is that complexity wears down our willpower. The next big thought, intuitive judgment and biases, using mental shortcuts. Quote, why is it so difficult for us to think statistically? We easily think associatively, we think metaphorically, we think casually. But statistics require thinking about many things at once, which is something that System 1 is not designed to do. End quote. As we learn in the next section, The way our minds work with System 1 and System 2 creates certain mental biases that we must also consider. System 1, the fast-thinking part of our minds, has us relying more on intuitive judgments and educated guesses as a way of thinking. In the book, we explore this area in more detail. We learn, for example, about the law of small numbers, where we tend to ignore small sample sizes and we think we are recognizing patterns when they don't actually exist. The author uses the instance of seeing a basketball player make 3 or 4 baskets in a row and thinking he has a hot hand. In asking us to further consider this mental bias, the author asks, quote, "Do you discriminate sufficiently between I read in the New York Times and I heard at the water cooler?" End quote. Probably not. Mr. Kahneman points out that we're prone to exaggerate the consistency and coherence of what we see. We see a pattern in the randomness. There are many examples of, quote, random events that we attribute to some kind of pattern when it's not true. This is System 1 trying to tell us a narrative which we then believe. One implication of this is to try not to rush to judgment, but rather to consider whether there's enough data to make a correct decision. Another way we use mental shortcuts is a phenomenon called the anchoring effect. This happens when we're exposed to a numeric value before estimating the quantity of something. For example, quote, "If you consider how much you should pay for a house, you'll be influenced by the asking price. The same house will appear more valuable if its listing price is high than if it is low," end quote. In fine art auctions, the estimate anchors the value of the art that has an influence on the first bid. If you want to practice the anchoring effect yourself, try offering a really low offer the next time you're negotiating a price and see what happens. Both the law of small numbers and the anchoring effect demonstrate how our minds make certain mental shortcuts in favor of the fast-thinking aspect of our mind. We also take mental shortcuts in part based on the availability of the information and also the emotion attached to it. We think, for example, that risk from terrorists is much higher than it really is, and we also overrate the risk of accidents. Quote, "Death by accidents was judged to be more than 300 times more likely than death by a diabetes, but the true ratio is 1 to 4, end quote. There's more emotion attached to the idea of dying by accident, and the news makes this information more available to us. When we watch the news, filled with dramatic coverage of accidents, we conclude that the risk of an accident is much higher than it really is. What we should probably worry about instead is whether we should really be eating that double-stuffed pepperoni pizza while we're watching the news. The next big thought, overconfidence, how we ignore our own ignorance. Quote, "Our comforting conviction that the world makes sense rests on a secure foundation, our almost unlimited ability to ignore our own ignorance," end quote. There are certain illusions of understanding based on how our minds work. We create stories, and those stories help us to understand. Daniel Kahneman offers us something called the WYSIATI rule, which is an abbreviation for "what you see is all there is." He explains that, quote, "You build the best possible story from the information available to you, and if it's a good story, you believe it," end quote. It's actually easier to create a story when you don't know very much because there are fewer pieces to fit into the puzzle. We also learned about something called the illusion of validity. The System 1 part of our mind works in a way that jumps to conclusions even without much evidence. The author highlights that, quote, "For some of our most important beliefs, we have no evidence at all except that people we love and trust also hold those beliefs," end quote. Think about how this illusion of validity works in your own life. Do you have certain deep-seated beliefs about something for which you have no evidence? Perhaps there's a belief about money, religion, work, or relationships, or some other area that you have without ever having examined the evidence for or validity of that belief. Consider your beliefs and what premise you have in place as a result. The illusion of validity is reinforced in the book with the example of the stock market, which Mr. Kahneman calls, quote, "a major industry that appears to be built largely on an illusion of skill," end quote. He references a study by Terry Odian, a UC Berkeley finance professor who studied the trading records of 10,000 brokerage accounts over 7 years by individual investors. His conclusion, quote, "the results were unequivocally bad," end quote. the shares that they sold actually did much better than the shares they bought by a substantial margin. Mr. Kahneman reinforces this disappointing picture by saying, quote, "It is clear that for the large majority of individual investors, taking a shower and doing nothing would have been a better policy than implementing the ideas that came to their minds," end quote. Now, whether you are a successful investor or not, the point is that our minds hold on to certain illusions in order for us to have coherent stories. The next big thought: choices. Not all of them are rational. Quote, "People are loss averse," end quote. Let's move on to consider choices and how we make them. In the next part of the book, the author illustrates our lack of rational decision-making by highlighting a number of different studies. They used simple gambling situations as a way to quickly gauge whether someone was willing to take certain risks, to realize gains, or to possibly experience losses. There's a certain prevalent economic theory called utility theory. Without getting too complicated here, let's just say that if you lose $500, this is assumed to be the same amount of utility as if you gained $500. It's either a plus or a minus, but the utility or value to you is still $500. In further studies, however, it was determined that people have loss aversion. Essentially, quote, "losses loom larger than gains," end quote. Why is that? The author points to our evolutionary history. Avoiding threats is more important than pursuing opportunities for organisms to survive. When you lose that $500, then, it matters more to you. Something called the endowment effect further enhances this idea. Owning something seems to increase its value. In a study using coffee mugs with university logos, those who were given the mug wanted double the selling price to part with it than those who did not have the mug were willing to pay. This is fascinating and helps explain why it's so darn hard to get rid of that old set of golf clubs or that designer purse that you never use. Yes, you are a victim of the endowment effect. You think it's worth much more than if you were to just go online and rebuy it. The idea of losses and threats looming larger in our minds is also enforced in finding that angry faces are processed faster by our minds than happy faces. The author explains that, quote, "the brains of humans and other animals contain a mechanism that is designed to give priority to bad news," end quote. In many ways, we operate according to how scholars titled a paper on this topic, "Bad is Stronger Than Good." They referenced John Gottman, a marital relationship expert who observed that the success of a relationship in the long term depends more on avoiding the bad rather than seeking the good. Are you leaving your socks strewn on the floor, dishes in the sink, or some other seemingly minor annoyance? Think again, because those dozen roses just aren't going to make up for that bad behavior in the long term. The next big thought: two selves, the experiencing self and the remembering self. Quote, "the photographer does not view the scene as a moment to be savored, but as a future memory to be designed," end quote. In the last section of Thinking Fast and Slow, we are exposed to the idea that we have two different selves, the experiencing self and the remembering self. The essential idea is that the good or bad parts of what you experience are enhanced or made better or worse by your remembering self. If you took a vacation to Italy, and while you were there, you experienced both the pleasure of seeing great Italian artwork and the pain of being stuck in a crowded middle airplane seat, your remembering self might forget all about the amazing art while you decide never to fly coach again. Mr. Kahneman suggests that, quote, "the remembering self and the experiencing self must both be considered because their interests do not always coincide," end quote. How might this impact our own lives and society as a whole? We should note that short, intense moments or periods of happiness or unhappiness could be much more important than the overall experience to us in the long run. To consider again that vacation example, if we have a few incredible days during our vacation and that positive memory lasts our whole lives, then the value of those great vacation memories are much higher than we might have originally considered. Quote, "similarly, a brief, awful event that causes PTSD should be weighted by the total duration of the long-term misery it causes," end quote. In other words, the very bad and the very good experiences really impact our minds a lot. as we consider decisions by the government and society about overall well-being, this idea of the experiencing self and the remembering self are something very interesting and important to consider. As Lifebook members, this idea can also greatly influence your own quality of life strategies, giving even more weight to those super high quality experiences and life's moments that you plan for and then realize. The final big thought, experienced well-being, what really makes us happy. Quote, "It is only a slight exaggeration to say that happiness is the experience of spending time with people you love and who love you." End quote. In recent years, the science of well-being has evolved. As we learn more, we can apply that new information into our own lives. In this final section, we'd like to share just a few ideas from the book to get you thinking more deeply about your own well-being. The author and his colleagues developed a more rigorous way of measuring well-being by considering feelings that people were actually experiencing versus previous ways of measuring simply from a questionnaire. Some of their findings include: situational factors are very important, including physical health and social contact. The author says that, quote, "Not surprisingly, a headache will make a person miserable, and the second best predictor of the feelings of a day is whether a person did or did not have contacts with friends and relatives," end quote. We must also consider the negative emotions in addition to the positives when measuring our happiness and well-being. In their study, they found that American women were in an unpleasant state about 19% of the time, compared to French women, 16%, and Danish women, 14%. One explanation for this, the author suggests, is that American women have less access to childcare and spend more time driving their children to various activities, and so have less time to actually enjoy their kids. Yes, you love your kids, but are you spending enjoyable quality time with them, or are you spending your time feeling stressed? And what about marriage or living with your spouse or partner? In a study cited in the book, quote, "There was no overall difference in experienced well-being between women who lived with a mate and women who did not," end quote. Why is this the case? Women who are with a mate have less time alone, but also have much less time with their friends. Quote, "They spend more time making love, which is wonderful, but also more time doing housework, preparing food and caring for children, all relatively unpopular activities," end quote. In conclusion, with any life choice that impacts our overall well-being, we must consider both the unpleasant factors in addition to the pleasant factors in making our choice. Both the bad and the good matter. As a society, we should also consider ways to reduce those unpleasant factors. For example, such as finding ways to reduce commuting time or improving childcare options for working parents. Being happy isn't just smelling the roses. We also must remove some of the thorns. So there we have it, Daniel Kahneman's research-based insights about how the mind works that you can apply in your everyday life. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to sharing with you again soon. And until next time, here's to moving one book closer to living 12 Category Smart.